Boy, that summer went by fast. Good to be here, though, and begin with something that I've done periodically. I'm thinking it'd be kind of good to start this on a regular basis as the first Sunday school, adult Sunday school lesson. Very important. One of the things that I learned from my ministry in New Rochelle, having gone through some grave difficulties in the last several years of that ministry, was to teach on how to deal with differences, how to deal with problems in the church. If we learn biblical communication, we will avoid dividing the church and avoid divisions and things that are unhealthy for the body of Christ. And the Bible, of course, has tons to say about this. We could go on and I could teach an entire year on biblical communication. But here, a number of years ago, this would be way back in New Rochelle, I got a book called Loving God with All Your Mind by Jean Edward Veith. He's a Lutheran. And in fact, I think that Janelle Kamerman used one of his books on men at work or God at work through his church or something like that. But it's about vocation. And Janelle used that, I think, at the women's retreat. And this book, Loving God with All Your Mind, is really meant for students who are going from high school into college. And they're oftentimes going from a Christian learning environment into a non-Christian environment. And even with Christian colleges, you have all kinds of non-Christian things happening there, and you have sinners. So in some ways, not as radically different as one might think. In fact, I've just given to both Madison and Mason this book, because not only does it teach this way of loving and truthful communication in the very first chapter, but it also goes on to talk about the modern mind. And Veith is really a genius at he's taught in secular universities most of his career up until about the last decade, and he really understands the secular mind. And so acquainting college students, equipping them to be able to detect the secular web of thinking out there is a very important part of being prepared to go off to college wherever you go. But here, in the first chapter, he deals with the whole business of communicating. How did Daniel deal in a very hostile, in some ways, environment, hostile in that it was paganism in Babylon? How did he deal with the differences that he immediately encountered as a student at the University of Babylon, which is, he was enrolled in the finest learning environment in the ancient world by King Nebuchadnezzar. And so let's listen to Daniel chapter 1. The word of the Lord. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. And then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. And they were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. And therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink, for why should he see that you were worse in condition than the youths who are of your own age? And so you would endanger my head with the king." And then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink, and then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see." So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And therefore they stood before the king in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them. He found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of Cyrus. And thus far in the reading of God's holy word. One of the things that I have noted, and I'm sure I participated in it, especially as a young man, is that it's very easy when you have the truth to become self-righteous and even a little bit pugilistic. I think I have a label for the reformed who end up being constantly annoying and obnoxious in that way. The reformed pugilists, they're always get their dukes up with the truth and ready to fight everyone that disagrees with them. And this is something that Gene Veith saw a lot at, I think he taught at the University of Kentucky for many decades, and he saw that a lot with Christians coming into the secular environment. And so that's what really urged him to write this first chapter of the book. I'm realizing that there is a biblical way to hold your convictions without compromising, and yet with also winning those around you, that is, to the best of your ability. And so the first thing that we notice here is that we are really called to carefully consider the nature of the disagreement that we have. Very important, verse 8a, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Now, what's going on here? Was Daniel a vegan, and was he against the consumption of alcoholic beverages? And the answer would be no. He's actually obeying the word of God in Leviticus 17. Now, I know people today that still believe that this is in place, and so, you know, there's no lobsters or seafood, none of those good things like steamed clams, and they just mistake the fact that in the Old Testament there's something there symbolically and ceremonially that's now done away with. Acts 10 makes that painfully clear that those distinctions were unique. But in Daniel's day, this was absolute truth. This was something God had told them, that what makes you distinct is not eating the cuisine of the pagans around you. And so, you know, here was a very important difference that he held. And oftentimes we kind of lump everything together as if there were not degrees of difference. There ought to be things that we're willing to die for, like the gospel, like the Trinity, like the deity of Christ. There ought to be other things which we ought to be willing to take a firm stand on and argue biblically, and when I say argue, I mean with gentleness and intelligence from the Bible, like Presbyterian church government. And there are many things like that that we should hold, not in the same place as the deity of Christ and those sorts of things, but we ought to recognize that we do believe that's absolute truth, but we realize that there are others who don't agree with us. We have dear Baptist friends who have very different views of church government, and as well those who are Episcopalians and who believe in a hierarchical way of governing and organizing the church. Also, you might think of, is homeschooling the only way to educate our children? Is birth control sin? These are all things where faithful, God-loving, Christ-honoring Christians disagree, and where we need to be very careful not to be dogmatic about what we believe. Present your case and realize that these are things that are not in the same place as absolute truth. Problem is that we sometimes make absolute truth out of relatives, and that's a place where I think we can get into trouble. And it takes, one of the ways of helping us in this area is to know what's going on out there. It's one of the reasons I get Christianity Today, because it gives you an idea of what the broad evangelical world is thinking. And I like to talk to people that I don't agree with and find out what are they thinking and why do they think what they think, so that we can have a broad understanding of what sincere Christians may hold to that are different from what we hold to. And so working to understand the other side then is really part of this, getting to know the nature of the disagreement. And so think about the king, Nebuchadnezzar, you know, a real mixed bag in the Bible. We see him really what appears to have repented when he gets humble later on in the book of Daniel. But here, what would be his motive for feeding the king's food? It's the food he ate and the wine he drank. So we're talking about the best cuisine in the kingdom. What would be his motivation for doing this? Because he hated Daniel and the God of Daniel? No. He didn't really know very much about the God of Daniel, but he believed that this was the right way to, this was the healthy way, this was good for them in order to make them healthy, give them this great language and literature, that's sort of the liberal arts education of ancient Babylon, so that they would be able to be wise in ruling in his kingdom and being part of the king's court. So his motivation was not an evil one in and of itself. And so to understand that, Daniel, he understood it, and he understood then a wise course would be to show that by just they're eating just vegetables and water, that they're not going to undermine the king's intention of good health. And so it's very important to understand the other side. Remember, a friend of mine was lamenting on Charlie Dennison before he died that in seminaries we don't have as many professors as we once did, like back in the Princeton days when Machen and Hodges were teaching, to really understand those who are our theological opponents, especially liberals, to really understand what they believe before we critique it. And I had a professor back at Covenant College, Gordon H. Clark, who was wonderful at this. He was a very stern professor until you got to know him. He had a big heart underneath the stern facade. But he reminded us of Alfred Hitchcock, actually. He'd take off his watch, and he'd take his pocket watch out, and he'd set it on the table and watch it very carefully. He started on time and ended on time. This guy was disciplined in every way in his life. And he disciplined us. I was a hippie, you know, had come out of American version of Zen Buddhism. And so, you know, I had no academic discipline. Well, he taught me how to take a section of Augustine, for example, De Magistro on the teacher, and take that and completely understand it and outline it so that what I'm saying has nothing of my opinion in it whatsoever. It's all about what Augustine said in De Magistro, and that's what you're going to be writing from me. And I don't want your opinions about anything. I want Augustine. And if you read his book, if you're interested in philosophy, Thales to Dewey is probably one of the best single-volume philosophies that you can find, a history of philosophy. And in it, he really, I mean, you can get in 30 pages, you can get more of Kant than you could get from probably any other source. And so he taught me to think, and now as a pastor, that's what I have to wrestle in. We have to, as a session, work at trying to put ourselves in the other person's shoes. What is another person thinking? What is motivating them? Do I really understand their position, where they're coming from? And it's not that we always do a good job at this, but this is what we have to do in dealing with differences. We've got to really see if we understand the other person's position. And sometimes this means that we need to just ask a lot of questions. Is this what you really think? You know, if you have an opportunity, because when you're dealing with a dead philosopher, you just all you have is what that person wrote. But we need to really put ourselves in the other person's shoes. And, of course, the steward, it's funny, in some translations he's called Melzar. So you have Ashpenaz is the head of the eunuchs. And one of the eunuchs that dealt with Daniel and his three friends is called Melzar, but it's actually simply the Hebrew word for steward. Anyway, he sympathizes with Melzar because Melzar says, basically, if you guys look weak and don't look as healthy as your peers, my head's going off. And he meant that literally because that was the steward's responsibility, was to make sure that they were healthy young men so that they could serve a long time in the king's court. And then encourage disagreement to test your ideas. I mean, one of the things that we try to do on the session, and again, I'm sure we don't do this perfectly, but we try to, when we're discussing issues, to listen carefully to one another, to encourage disagreement so that we're not afraid to speak up and say, hey, I have a different view of this topic. And this way, we hopefully come up with wiser solutions in the end. And so if we're to speak to unbelievers in 1 Peter 3:16 with gentleness and respect, how we ought to be careful to speak with one another and with fellow Christians with whom we may disagree with gentleness and respect. So that's carefully consider the nature of the disagreement. So important in loving our neighbor. The second thing is to humbly submit to God's authority structure. Notice this in verse 11. Then Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned, and that steward there is the word Melzar, which some translations put as a proper name. And so Daniel approaches the authority structure. He doesn't just stop eating the king's food. Now, that's what we as Americans, we're just terrible that way. It's like, I'm the ultimate authority here in my life. We all have some of this in us, and some more than others. But this is totally against the biblical view of God's authority structure. And remember that the authority structure, Romans 13, in the world, there in the king's court, in Nebuchadnezzar's court, is there because God put it there. That's what he tells us. All authorities in the world and in the church are given by God. They're instituted by God. And to remember that is not only comforting to know that while, sure, there's corruption everywhere, but by and large, it's amazing how much order the Lord preserves in the world in his common grace and his providence. And so Daniel understood this. You don't just go off and decide on your own that you're not going to eat the king's diet. You go and you talk to the steward that's under the chief of the eunuchs, and you talk to him about what you're concerned about. And so he humbly submitted, you know, that he denied himself. He did not deny the absolute truth of his diet, which was there in Leviticus 17 that he had to uphold. But he went about it using God's authority structure. And if we do that, we will be much happier people and we'll keep the peace both with our neighbors and in the church. And so Romans 13 means, of course, there is Paul's call for us to obey, pay our taxes, be respectful of God's authority structure out there in the world in Roman culture. And then, though, is also Jesus in Matthew 5 and Matthew 18. He tells us that we've got to go and follow the authority structure within the church. And so if we have aught against a brother or sister, we go to them. It's funny how we don't tend to do that by nature. We tend to want to go behind people's back and get things done. And then we tend to gossip and speak ill of our neighbor behind their backs. And this is exactly what Jesus says. Don't do that. Deal with it personally. Deal with it directly. And then only if they won't listen, Matthew 18, then go to the next level in God's ecclesiastical authority structure. Shay? Yeah, well, that's a good question, and actually there is an answer to that, and that is that if you look at, and we're going to come to this under the next point, that you have to live with the consequences, as Peter and John did when they were told not to preach the gospel. They said, we've got to obey God rather than man. And so when it comes to absolute truth, we have to obey God rather than man. Even that, we should do respectfully, though. We don't do it bombastically, you know, like, who are you to tell me what to do? No, they simply said, no, we've got to submit to God, and we're willing to take the stripes. And then they got their stripes, and they went out, and they continued to preach the gospel. Acts 4 and 5 is fascinating. I've just been reading that in my devotions, and it really shows you the balance there between respecting the authorities, but always God is above those authorities. So the authority can never tell us to do something which is overtly contrary to God's absolute truth. And in this case, it was preaching the gospel, but it might be an ethical principle. So if a doctor or a nurse was forced by a hospital to participate in an abortion, they'd have to be willing to take the consequences and probably, in many cases, lose their jobs. And we're going to find this happening more and more when people realize what we believe, that we're going to be called intolerant, and there will be some workplaces that we just will not be accepted in because of that. We have to accept those consequences. I don't know what would have happened here, but I know that what did happen there in Acts 4 and 5 shows us that there can be some very negative consequences to obeying God, that is temporally negative.
It's probably because, not being Jewish, I wouldn't have died.
I know. We just think water and vegetables all the time. It's like, okay, well, there are some vegetables that I really like a lot, but I'm not sure. And I'm going to get into, we're a little bit ahead on that topic, but we'll talk about that. But in ancient Israel, this was part of their identity. So this was part of their witness to the world, that they were a unique people and that God was their Lord. Greg? Yeah, I never thought of that, Greg, and I think that's a very good point, that that certainly would be all part of the idea that what was forbidden there also had to do with, it wasn't just the distinctiveness of Israel's identity, but with those were things that were offered as sacrifices, which in turn would be looking forward to Christ. So there was it was really central to the worship and identity of Israel. Now, since the sacrifice has been made in the new covenant, that's where the Lord tells Peter, you know, with all of these unclean animals, not to eat those. That's the end of this dietary law. But it definitely had that angle of sacrifice as well. But I'm thinking that a lot of it was, I mean, even wine was not forbidden. And yet I think that there was here, one of the things not to forget about this whole chapter is that already you see something uniquely supernatural happening here with Daniel. I mean, look at this. He's not only does he learn the language and literature of Babylon, but he has understanding in all visions and dreams. So this is not an ordinary part of a Christian education or even of a liberal education. There's something supernatural going on here. And so I was going to say this later, but I'll say it now because we're on this topic, that this is not in any way, here's a great place where you could take this out of context and say, God wants me to be a vegan and just drink water. And this is, I think it's a supernatural test. So it's the beginning. Remember, what's happening in the book of Daniel is that you're saying that you're seeing God challenging the wisdom of the unbelieving nation of Babylon and showing it. Just like it reminds us of what? Of the Exodus. And in the Exodus, what do you see happening with the plagues? We were just reminded of this in our Sunday school training yesterday, that the plagues were all challenges to each of the gods of Egypt. And so the darkness is a challenge to the sun god. It's like, where's your sun god now? It's darkness because I, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, I am the one in charge of the sun. I created the sun. And so that's happening here in Daniel, right at the very beginning, that we're seeing not that a vegetable water diet only would be better than the king's diet in terms of physical health, but showing that God is the one who gives health, and God is the one who is in control of Daniel and his three friends. So there's a supernatural reality that's entering in right at the beginning, challenging the wisdom of the unbelieving, idolatrous nation of Babylon. And notice there that it says that, how does it end this segment? He found them to be 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. So they were 10 times better. This is a huge statement that God, Yahweh, the God of these four men, is superior to the gods of Babylon. So back to that topic of humbly submit to God's authority structure, it's interesting, if you look in our confession in chapter 24 on divorce, it specifically says that people who are engaged in a divorce are not in a proper position to judge the rightness or wrongness of that, or the process, the proper process to go through if it is a biblically legitimate divorce. And so it basically says there are two authorities that people seeking a divorce need to submit to: ecclesiastical, the church, and the government, the civil government. And so it's very, very clear on that, and I think simply implementing biblical principles. And so then, as we've said here, so the proper authority structure, we don't always run. I mean, if my neighbor's dog is barking his brains out continuously, we've had that happen, you probably have too, and it's just like, okay, this has got to stop. You don't go call the police. You go and you ask them to say nicely, you know, your dog keeps barking when you're away. You wouldn't know that, but we do because we're here. And could you please do something about that? That's the way to approach that. And we don't go to the police right away. And so that personal encounter is so important. And today, with our electronic devices, which are supposed to make us more communicative, but they actually distance us from the ability to have face-to-face interaction and sometimes confrontations. You know, we're afraid to do that. It's like, okay, I'm going to go some other route. I'm going to email, text, or go to the police. And that's just not the right way to do that. And so remember that Proverbs 6 says, there are 6 things that the Lord hates, 7 that are an abomination to him. And that last one is the one who sows discord among brothers. This is a plague of the church when a lack of godly communication takes place. So using God's authority structure, but always beginning with a personal approach when that is appropriate. And then the third thing is to formulate a plan to deal with the difference and use the one-day test. Think about a plan. Think about when you have a criticism of something, and it may be a very legitimate criticism, if you can. Now, this is not always possible. I mean, someone might come to the session and say, you know, I think we need something, and I don't have a plan how to do it, but I think this is something we need. That's legitimate, so we're not saying that you always have to have a definite plan. But Daniel had a plan, and his plan was, test us for 10 days and see if we're not healthier, or at least as healthy. And so that plan proves to be a perfect opportunity, of course, for the Lord to act. And here again, this is something supernatural. I don't know about whether an all-vegetable diet and water would be healthier than, let's say, a regular diet with the three food groups. I don't know. I'm not a nutritionist. But the point here is definitely that it's something supernatural that's happening. God has intervened. And this is a tip-off, of course, of the big theme of Daniel. And over the next six chapters, what you see is continually God intervening, God intervening, God intervening miraculously. And finally, that Nebuchadnezzar is humbled. And so that theme that God is superior, he is the true and living God, superior to the idols of the nations, is here. But that doesn't take away from these practical lessons that we need to implement. And so it's always good if we have an alternative, then that's important. But in some cases, and this goes back to Shay's question, with Peter and John, you have to learn to simply live with the consequences. And I know people that have lost jobs because of their Christian convictions. And it wasn't that they were... I've known people that lost jobs because they were Christian pugilists. And so they were not easy to get along with. And that was why they lost their job. And Peter, in the passage that we'll actually read this morning in our worship, Peter says, you know, if you get punished for sin, there's no glory in that. It's when you take it like Christ did, when you're innocent and being treated unjustly, that's when the Lord is glorified. And so this is the case here with Peter and John. They respectfully submit to their punishment, but they also say respectfully, but clearly, we can't stop preaching the gospel because we are to obey God rather than men. And so then the final thing would be to learn to live with differences. And so this is where it sometimes is hard. And we've, you know, I've known people that have come to visit our church and they have a list of stuff. They want to know, do you believe in A, B, C, D, E, F, G? And maybe only one of those is really a super important thing. And others are just things that we have decided not to do such and such. Let's say an example would be some of our OP churches have a choir, and we don't. And we have certain reasons why we don't, but we don't judge them for having a choir. And we expect that if they were to become members of our church, they wouldn't start sort of a campaign to start a choir. And the session down the road might decide that that's what would be good for the church. But this is just an example of people, when they come to a church, need to learn to live with differences. And we need to learn. There are differences right here in this room on probably a number of topics, some important, some more important than others. But the fact is that you cannot change the world and the church. And probably the most important thing, when we're dealing with differences of opinion about things that are of relative truth, then our humility and our Christ-likeness in living and loving others that differ with us on things, that's more important than any of those particular issues. And I believe that that's an area where the church needs, we just need to constantly be alert to the importance of this. Ephesians chapter 4 is a wonderful example here where Paul makes this plea with the Ephesian Christians. He says, I therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, and here he's literally in prison, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love. So there you have, there's a burden, bearing with one another in love. There's some people that can be, we can really annoy one another, you know, and love will overlook that. And that comes by grace. It comes by supernatural. Here's the supernatural intervening against our natural tendencies to make us eager. Now, he goes on, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit
in the bond of peace. And then he goes on to talk about that unity. But here's a beautiful call then to labor at, to be eager, to be enthusiastic about maintaining the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. One of the things I think happens in Reformed churches is that we, and I can remember when I first became a Christian out of the counterculture, it was like, goodbye relativism. It was like, goodbye, there's no truth and everything's truth and everything's wonderful, and this hodgepodge mess of huge ethical compromises and corruption in our nation. So it was so nice to come into the church where there's truth. There's right and there's wrong, there's truth and there's falsehood. But that's not all. And so we have to realize that in holding the truth, we're called to do it in a way that is Christ-like. But I noticed that Stephen, I just read through the 7th chapter of Acts this week, and Stephen imitated his Savior by, when he's being stoned to death unjustly, he says, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." So that should be our attitude towards fellow Christians for whom Christ also died. And this will promote the peace and the unity of the church. Above all, says Peter, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins. Notice it doesn't just say disagreements. It actually means sins. Now, there's a place where we've got to talk to one another about sin and confront that in a loving way. So Galatians 6:1 and a whole bunch of other places in Scripture. But that's what the Bible says, quoting from Proverbs, since love covers a multitude of sins. Love one another earnestly. And when we deal with differences in a Christ-like way, this is exactly what we will do. Questions or comments? Daniel. Yes, so the idea of separation there in Daniel has to do with keeping his people pure, but notice it's in the midst of the world. I think one of the other great things about Daniel is that you see how Daniel maintains this. We'll see actually later on that what they do hold against him, they're looking for, you know, there's always in government and in any organization, there's jealousy, there's envy that functions. And so they're envious of Daniel. And the one thing they can find is that he prays 3 times a day to Jerusalem. He heads towards Jerusalem, where, of course, the temple is. And so that's what they get him on that. And we see how the Lord, you know, saves him with flying colors. But he's not afraid to maintain that devotion and his prayer to God. But he's doing it and living and being a wise counselor there in the government of Nebuchadnezzar. But he remains pure. So holiness doesn't mean separating ourselves geographically and socially from unbelievers, but it means separating ourselves unto the Lord in the midst of living in an unbelieving world. Bill.
Based on, you know, just the word on the printed.
Yeah, so the question is there the theme of the godly lives of Daniel and his friends earn the respect of those around them in Nebuchadnezzar's government? And I think absolutely, and you see this, but what's interesting is that in the Joseph story would be another classic example of this, where Joseph, in every place where he ends up, he earns the respect, but God gives him favor. So it's God working through them to give them favor. And of course, we know that there are exceptions to that. And, of course, the cross would be the greatest exception in the history of injustice, that they hated him. And, of course, the evil one behind the scenes of history was working to make sure that his life was snuffed out. And as we'll see this morning, in that very crushing, Satan is crushed. So it's a magnificent story. And Joseph is a type of Christ. You know, in the Lucan narrative of the gospel, it says after he goes to Jerusalem and comes back, remember, with his parents, that he grows in favor with God and man. So that's a theme throughout the whole Bible. But in fact, at the very end, his task, his mission, is to die for sinners. And that he doesn't turn his face from.